He stopped for the briefest instant, but she did not answer the appeal, and he finished with the same quiet gentleness. "Well, that was why I wanted to see the motor." "I understand," she said softly. The tone of her voice was the only form of acknowledgment she could grant him. "Miss Taggart," he said, his eyes lowered, looking at the glass case, "I know a man who might be able to undertake the reconstruction of that motor. He would not work for me, so he is probably the kind of man you want." But by the time he raised his head, and before he saw the look of admiration in her eyes, the open look he had begged for, the look of forgiveness, he destroyed his single moment's atonement by adding in a voice of drawing-room sarcasm, "Apparently the young man had no desire to work for the good of society or the welfare of science. He told me that he would not take a government job. I presume he wanted the bigger salary he could hope to obtain from a private employer." He turned away, not to see the look that was fading from her face, not to let himself know its meaning. "Yes," she said, her voice hard. "He is probably the kind of man I want. He's a young physicist from the Utah Institute of Technology," he said dryly. "His name is Quentin Daniels. A friend of mine sent him to me a few months ago. He came to see me, but he would not take the job I offered. I wanted him on my staff. He had the mind of a scientist. I don't know whether he can succeed with your motor, but at least he has the ability to attempt it. I believe you can still reach him at the Utah Institute of Technology. I don't know what he's doing there now. They closed the institute a year ago." "Thank you, Dr. Statler. I shall get in touch with him. If you want me to, I'll be glad to help him with the theoretical part of it. I'm going to do some work myself, starting from the leads of that manuscript. I'd like to find the cardinal secret of energy that its author had found. It's his basic principle that we must discover. If we succeed, Mr. Daniels may finish the job, as far as your motor is concerned." "I will appreciate any help you may care to give me, Dr. Statler." They walked silently through the dead tunnels of the terminal, down the ties of a rusted track under a string of blue lights, to the distant glow of the platforms. At the mouth of the tunnel they saw a man kneeling on the track, hammering at a switch, with the unrhythmical exasperation of uncertainty. Another man stood watching him impatiently. "Well, what's the matter with the damn thing?" asked the watcher. "Don't know. You've been at it for an hour." "Yeah. How long is it going to take?" "Who is John Galt?" Dr. Stadler winced. They had gone past the men when he said, "I don't like that expression." "I don't either," she answered. "Where did it come from?" "Nobody knows." They were silent. Then he said, "I knew a John Galt once, only he died long ago."
"Who was he?"
"I used to think that he was still alive, but now I'm certain that he must have died. He had such a mind that had he lived, the whole world would have been talking of him by now."
"But the whole world is talking of him."
He stopped still.
"Yes,"
he said slowly, staring at a thought that had never struck him before.
"Yes.
Why?" The word was heavy with the sound of terror.
"Who was he, Dr. Statler?
Why are they talking of him?
Who was he?"
He shook his head with a shudder and said sharply, "It's just a coincidence. The name is not uncommon at all. It's a meaningless coincidence. It has no connection with the man I knew. That man is dead." He did not permit himself to know the full meaning of the words he added. "He has to be dead." The order that lay on his desk was marked confidential, emergency, priority, essential needs certified by Office of Top Coordinator for the account of Project X, and demanded that he sell 10,000 tons of Reardon metal to the State Science Institute. Reardon read it and glanced up at the superintendent of his mills, who stood before him without moving. The superintendent had come in and put the order down on his desk without a word. "I thought you'd want to see it," he said in answer to Reardon's glance. Reardon pressed a button summoning Miss Ives. He handed the order to her and said, "Send this back to wherever it came from. Tell them that I will not sell any Reardon metal to the State Science Institute." Gwen Ives and the superintendent looked at him, at each other, and back at him again.
What he saw in their eyes was congratulation.
"Yes, Mr. Reardon," Gwen Ives said formally, taking the slip as if it were any other kind of business paper.
She bowed and left the room. The superintendent followed.
Reardon smiled faintly, in greeting to what they felt. He felt nothing about that paper, or its possible consequences. By a sort of inner convulsion, which had been like tearing a plug out to cut off the current of his emotions, he had told himself 6 months ago, "Act first. Keep the mills going. Feel later." It had made him able to watch dispassionately the working of the Fair Share Law. Nobody had known how that law was to be observed. First, he had been told that he could not produce Reardon metal in an amount greater than the tonnage of the best special alloy other than steel produced by Orrin Boyle. But Orrin Boyle's best special alloy was some cracking mixture that no one cared to buy. Then he had been told that he could produce Reardon metal in the amount that Orrin Boyle could have produced if he could have produced it. Nobody had known how this was to be determined. Somebody in Washington had announced a figure, naming a number of tons per year, giving no reasons. Everybody had let it go at that. He had not known how to give every consumer who demanded it an equal share of Reardon metal. The waiting list of orders could not be filled in 3 years, even had he been permitted to work at full capacity. New orders were coming in daily. They were not orders any longer in the old honorable sense of trade. They were demands. The law provided that he could be sued by any consumer who failed to receive his fair share of Reardon metal. Nobody had known how to determine what constituted a fair share of what amount. Then a bright young boy just out of college had been sent to him from Washington as deputy director of distribution. After many telephone conferences with the Capitol, the boy announced that customers would get 500 tons of the metal each, in the order of the dates of their applications. Nobody had argued against his figure. There was no way to form an argument. The figure could have been 1 pound or 1,000,000 tons, with the same validity. The boy had established an office at the Reardon Mills, where 4 girls took applications for shares of Reardon metal. At the present rate of the mill's production, the applications extended well into the next century. 500 tons of Reardon metal could not provide 3 miles of rail for Taggart Transcontinental. It could not provide the bracing for one of Ken Daniger's coal mines. The largest industries, Reardon's best customers, were denied the use of his metal. But golf clubs made of Reardon metal were suddenly appearing on the market, as well as coffee pots, garden tools, and bathroom faucets. Ken Daniger, who had seen the value of the metal and had dared to order it against a fury of public opinion, was not permitted to obtain it. His order had been left unfilled, cut off without warning by the new laws. Mr. Moen, who had betrayed Taggart Transcontinental in its most dangerous hour, was now making switches of Reardon metal and selling them to the Atlantic Southern. Reardon looked on, his emotions plugged out. He turned away without a word when anybody mentioned to him what everybody knew, the quick fortunes that were being made on Reardon metal. "Well, no," people said in drawing rooms. "You mustn't call it black market, because it isn't really. Nobody is selling the metal illegally. They're just selling their right to it. Not selling, really. Just pooling their shares." He did not want to know the insect intricacy of the deals through which the shares were sold and pooled, nor how a manufacturer in Virginia had produced in 2 months 5,000 tons of castings made of Reardon metal, nor what man in Washington was that manufacturer's unlisted partner. He knew that their profit on a ton of Reardon metal was 5 times larger than his own. He said nothing. Everybody had a right to the metal, except himself. The young boy from Washington, whom the steelworkers had nicknamed the wet nurse, hung around Reardon with a primitive, astonished curiosity, which incredibly was a form of admiration. Reardon watched him with disgusted amusement. The boy had no inkling of any concept of morality. It had been bred out of him by his college. This had left him an odd frankness, naive and cynical at once, like the innocence of a savage.